Studio 360 is supported by 23andMe. The DNA kit from 23andMe is designed to provide more than 200 personalized health reports and the knowledge to make informed decisions about personal health. A personalized DNA kit is available at 23andMe.com/Studio360.
Today in Studio 360, we're on stage at the Aspen Ideas Festival with the great playwright and actress Sarah Jones.
Every time I get nervous, I start to talk really fast. Nobody can understand nothing I'm saying, which is very frustrating for me, as you can imagine. Usually I just have to take a deep breath. So.
And more Sarah Jones.
I'm just so pleased to be here with all of you. I'm quelling. I mean, the list of the luminaries you have, these brilliant minds.
And even more Sarah Jones.
Kurt, I feel like rappers and these public intellectuals, you know, we got a lot in common.
And we wring a public confession out of anti-establishment songwriter Steve Earle.
You know, I've taken money from really huge corporations for most of my career. I was on major labels for a long time.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and that's all ahead on this week's special edition of Studio 360, recorded live at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Stay with us.
Farewell, I'm bound to roam. This ain't never been my home.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today's show was recorded live on stage at the Aspen Ideas Festival a few years back with some of my favorite guests ever, including actor-writer Sarah Jones and singer-songwriter Steve Earle. I started the show on stage with Sarah.
You know, I really didn't know what to expect from the Aspen Ideas Festival.
I should have told you. It's this magnificent place to spend a week in the summer discussing environmental degradation and global inequality and terrorism.
Right. Yes, no, would have appreciated it.
But you've been on some of the panels. How's that gone?
You know, actually, I wasn't going to comment on that because, honestly, the people who are part of this, I mean, Bill Clinton, you know, Madeleine Albright, I really at first thought, what could I possibly have to say that would be distinguished enough to justify my participation in something like this? And so I thought perhaps a very civilized sounding British accent might help things a bit. And then I thought, no, you know, I should really just get up there and talk the way I really talk. Because, you know, this is all about dialogue. And after all, I do speak the Queen's English. I am from Queens, New York.
And that's because you are Sarah Jones. And as the audience will soon discover, you make kind of a habit of pretending to be other people. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. And by the way, this whole Aspen Ideas Festival, it seems like a very public radio audience to me.
What exactly do you mean by that, Kurt?
Well, intelligent, curious, opinionated, white. I mean, practically the only black people here are the ones on stage.
I don't think I should weigh in on that one. I might call in some backup.
Okay. Hi. Hello, everybody. My name is Lorraine Levine. I am here because of Sarah Jones. She is a very nice young black girl, as you point out, Kurt. Well, she calls herself black. She's really more like a caramel color if you look at her. But anyway... I'm just so pleased to be here with all of you. I'm quelling. I mean, the list of the luminaries you have, these brilliant minds, you know.
Well, you know, the whole thing is run by Walter Isaacson, who, you know, wrote a biography of Benjamin Franklin, of Albert Einstein.
Oh, of course, Walter Isaacson. You know, he's only half Jewish, but even so, you know, wonderful, wonderful.
The other night I was at this incredible presentation, anti-corporate, anti-consumer products. And, of course, we were surrounded by the logos of the sponsors, Chevron and Mercedes.
You know what? I'm going to have to tell you, I feel you on that right there, Kurt. My name is Rashid. You know what I'm saying? What's up, everybody? I'm the only man Sarah Jones brought. You know what I'm saying? I think I'm the only rapper at this festival, you know what I'm saying? But for real, I know they were trying with the festival to be more inclusive, you know what I'm saying? So they offered us scholarships, you know what I'm saying? They was like, look, if you bring 5 box tops from some Nike sneakers, we'll bring y'all out here. So, you know, we had like a little arrangement.
And for a guy like you, how's that worked out? How do you feel like you're fitting in?
You know what? Actually, Kurt, I feel like rappers and these public intellectuals, you know, we got a lot in common. I mean, like you said, Mercedes is one of their sponsors. Y'all know how we love Mercedes. Y'all like to dress down. We like to dress down. I think I even saw Sandra Day O'Connor giving Colin Powell a hip-hop handshake. You know what I'm saying? I mean, well, some of y'all know better as a terrorist fist jab. So, you know, I definitely would have to say I feel like I'm in my element. You know what I'm saying?
And your element for tonight, yes. Is Studio 360, and we have a fabulous show coming up today. We have music from the great country rock singer-songwriter Steve Earle. And a little later, I'll talk with the Harvard professor Howard Gardner about how the mind works. And I'm told plenty more from the Tony Award-winning playwright Sarah Jones. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce the one and only Steve Earle.
Christmas time in Washington, Democrats rehearsed, getting into gear for 4 more years, but things not getting worse. Republicans drink whiskey neat, think they're lucky stars. They said he cannot seek another term. There'll be no more FDRs. And I sat home in Tennessee, staring at the screen, an uneasy feeling in my chest, wondering what it means. So come back, Woody Guthrie, come back to us now. J.O.S. from paradise and rise again somehow. If you run into Jesus, maybe he can help you out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now. I followed in your footsteps once, it's back in my traveling days. But somewhere I failed to find your trail, now I'm stumbling through the haze. There's killers on the highway now, and a man can't get around. So I sold my soul for wheels that roll, now I'm stuck here in this town. So come back, Woody Guthrie, come back to us now. J.O.I.'s from paradise and rise again somehow. If you run into Elvis, maybe he can help us out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now. Woody, there's foxes in the hen house. cows out in the corn. Our unions have been busted, their proud red banners torn. But if you listen to the radio, tell you all is well. But you, me, and Cisco know it's going straight to hell. So come back, Emma Goldman. Rise up, old Joe Hill. The barricades are going up. They cannot break our will. Come back to us, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. We're marching in the sound while the bells of freedom ring. And come back, Woody Guthrie. Back to us now. Till you rise from paradise and rise again somehow.
Thanks.
That is Steve Earle performing Christmas in Washington. We will hear a lot more from him in a minute. This is Studio 360 live at the Aspen Ideas Festival. From WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. Excellent.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by 23andMe. 23andMe provides a personal DNA kit so individuals can better understand how their genes impact health, which helps individuals and their doctors find health areas to keep an eye on. 23andMe also gives ancestry information and helps discover personal global origins or perhaps find living relatives. The Personal DNA Kit, designed to give individuals more control over their personal health. Available at 23andMe.com/Studio360.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today's show was recorded live on stage at the Aspen Ideas Festival in 2008.
My next guest has spent his scholarly career figuring out how we think and create. He is a Harvard professor of education and psychology and a MacArthur genius, and best known for his theory of multiple intelligences. Dr. Howard Gardner, welcome. Now, I think your most recent book is about how we change our minds, our own minds and those of other people. What do you mean when you say changing minds? The fact that I changed the shirt I was going to wear tonight, does that count or not?
Well, literally, of course, it counts, Kurt, but I'm interested in big changes of mind. For example, Einstein changed our sense of time and space. Picasso, people after Picasso painted, never painted the same. So I'm interested also in what happened after Darwin put out the theory of evolution. It changed, sooner or later, the minds of all scientists about the origins of life and the origins of species.
What is the last time that you, Howard Gardner, significantly changed your mind about something?
Well, when I think about my own life, probably the recent mind change was whether I would stop mostly doing research as an observer and become more of an activist. That was very, very hard for me. Scholars like to look at things and think about them and write about them, and we don't often like to stand in the fore. But in my life, both in terms of speaking out on issues and becoming more involved and actually trying to put some of my ideas into action by working with young people in high school and college, this is a really major mind change and a major action change. Whether that happened because I reached a certain age and got gutsier, or because I felt that having developed certain ideas, had an obligation to put them into action. My psychiatrist would have to tell you that.
Well, we have him on the phone, Howard. No. But we have gone to the audience and asked them for some stories about times they changed their minds. And we are first going to John at table four to get his story.
Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
My name is John. I live here in Aspen, Colorado. I manage a supermarket here in town. And probably my life-changing experience is I was a confirmed bachelor for 47 years. Never had any intentions of marrying, and I met a charming lady from Brazil by the salad bar in the city market. And we met, and the first time that I met, that I went out with her, I fell in love with her, and which I thought was real unusual because I had no intentions of ever getting married. And we married a year later, and we've subsequently gone to Brazil numerous times, and I fell in love with Brazil also. And Brazil is completely different from Aspen, a completely different culture.
So I understand.
Yeah.
Dr. Gardner, what do you make of that mind change? That's a serious commitment to one paradigm in John's life.
Well, you actually fell in love with somebody who had a very different background from you. And one of the questions I'd ask you, John, is had you gone out before with somebody who also came from a very, very different kind of background?
I'd spent some time in the Honduras, and I'd had a girlfriend down there in the Honduras, but marriage was not part of what our relationship was about.
Okay, well, this is very interesting to me. I'm not that kind of a psychiatrist, but you've had an interest in what we might say relatively exotic partners, but at a certain point, you decided that you wanted to convert this into marriage. Did you have a feeling that maybe this was your last chance?
Well, no, not at all.
Well, let's hope it was. Congratulations.
It is now, yes.
Great. We now have a question, or a life-changing, mind-changing story from Rebecca at table 31.
Hi, my name is Rebecca. I'm from Chicago, and my whole life I was a social drinker. I enjoyed drinking. When I turned 43, I realized that was the age at which my mother had become an alcoholic, and I decided to stop drinking so that I wouldn't have to worry about becoming an alcoholic myself.
It's a very brave way for you to talk about this, because I'm sure it wasn't very easy. Do you actually remember, did this come at one instant, or did you realize 43 was coming? How sudden was this this realization, and then how difficult was it for you to actually carry through? Because you can decide to stop drinking, but we know it doesn't necessarily follow that you're going to be successful.
Right. It was actually pretty sudden. I did the math. I realized that when I was 8, I became very aware that my mother, you know, really started drinking heavily, and she had me when she was 35. And I just did the math and realized I was the same age. And when I realized that, I actually, it was very easy. I just quit and have not regretted it. Feel two, much better.
Thank you. Two comments. It's interesting that for both of the first two people, for John and Rebecca, and I don't know them, this is what we would call a midlife kind of insight.
That's because everyone here is pretty old.
But let me talk now about what you did, we might call, in the language of psychology, little c creativity. You did something which was a transformation of mind and behavior. But as many people know, 50, 60 years ago, there was someone, I believe he was called Dr. Bob, who himself underwent a change, stopped drinking, but then he created Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, I would say, would be a big C creativity, because he transformed the minds and the behavior of thousands, perhaps millions of people. And this is a very important thing that I'd like to bring out, is that many of us have those transformations of mind which are very important for us, but where we might be somewhat different from an architect like Frank Gehry or Frank Lloyd Wright, is to take the individual mind change and then to paint it on a very wide scale. And if you do it well, Walter Isaacson will write a book about you.
If you're beloved enough. He only writes about beloved people. Have you ever noticed that?
Well, it's hard to write about someone if you find that you increasingly dislike them. That's what happened with Lawrence Thompson's book about Robert Frost. And he just didn't like him, and it was very hard to finish.
He changed his mind about
absolutely,
Robert Frost.
Right.
Imagine the road not taken there.
I just have to interrupt. I was not going to intrude, but I changed my mind. And I'm here because my name is Miss Lady. I have a question for you, both of you. And this is my first time here in Aspen. And I don't mind telling you, I'm from Chicago. I live on the street. So I am not your typical Aspen woman by any stretch. Let's just say that my budget for essentials like highlights and microdermabrasion has to take a backseat to my other essentials like 50-cent hot dogs. So, yes, clearly I would not fit in here long term, but it is a nice place to visit. Now, I do want to say that it feels very strange to me to be homeless in a place where some folks are depressed because they are second and third homeless. Now, think about that now. That's right. So my question to you is, with some of us living such a disparate, there's a word for y'all. That's a good Aspen Idea Festival type of vocabulary word. With some of us living such disparate reality, how do we bridge the gap, not just globally, but here at home, between the haves, the have-nots, and the have you lost your mind? That's more money than anybody can spend. That's what I want to know.
I guess Miss Lady would say forget changing minds. She thinks y'all have lost your mind.
Sarah, you know, I'm a professor, and if you ask me, I could profess for the next 3 weeks. I'm also a writer, and if you said to me, sit down and write, I could do it without any difficulty. But even if I lived to be 969 years of age, I would have no idea about what you do and how you do it. So tell us a bit, how does Sarah Jones manage to create convincingly these disparate, if not desperate, characters?
Right, both, right. I think that they come from what I hope is a deep well of empathy. And I've had a conversation about this with others who I admire who do this kind of work. I love Anna Deavere Smith. Meryl Streep has been a big mentor of mine and a presence in my life. And she says that acting is listening, and I know others have. And for me, acting is also, the ability to sort of think of another person's lot as your own for however long. And I guess I can imagine myself.
I can imagine myself as this person very easily, because there but for the grace of God, you know, even with or without the schmata,
you know.
And I also, you know, very much, I have, I think, somewhere beating in my heart, a lovely octogenarian Jewish woman. What can I tell you? You know.
So I think that, and it's not just older people, it's younger people. I identify with people very deeply, and that makes me committed to trying to capture the reality of who they are physically, vocally, emotionally.
One of the things I wondered was the extent to which, when you were in school, Sarah, were you already doing this sort of thing? Were you already shadowing people and trying to hear them?
Well, it's an excellent question, and you've earned all of your accolades in just this 1 second, because I went to the United Nations School, and I was surrounded by kids from lots of different backgrounds. I had already grown up in a multicultural family, and I think from childhood, I mean, I actually used to get in, well, I didn't get in big trouble, but I used to call the school nurse back before we had cell phones as my friend's parents and get us out of class so that we could go play hooky. So I remember learning out of necessity the ability to talk like this, to say, listen, my daughter, she's very ill today. Make sure that she is bundled up very carefully. Put her in the car park because I'm coming to pick her up. It's very important. And then we would all go off and play hooky all day.
It's terrible, but it's true.
She gives new meaning to multiple intelligences, I
guess. Yes, absolutely. So you're saying that one ingredient is empathy. Another one, though, is being surrounded by other people, very, very different kinds of people. And then you began to do some kind of experimenting, and I would guess that at a certain point you realized you were good at it, right?
Yes.
Good enough to get into trouble.
Right, good enough to get into trouble. Yeah.
The reason I ask about school is our usual notion of intelligence is people who are good in language and good in logic. And it's clear you're very good in language. We haven't established your logic. But one of the things we find out is people can be creative in very different kinds of intelligences. We're on radio, but those of us who are here can see that you have a lot of bodily intelligence. And you don't just project the voice, but you also put in an appearance, you hold yourself. And that's a very important part of what you do. As a professor, I just sort of stand there. It's not necessary for me to have any kind of bodily intelligence. Also, while you're using language, you're also using it musically. and especially when you're trying to imitate the rhythms and the textures of Jewish or whatever the group is. So I would say there's some musical intelligence, probably the most important intelligence, which we now realize is so important in life but not in school, is personal intelligence, which means both understanding other people and understanding yourself. I don't know what kind of self-understanding you have, but clearly you have a deep understanding of other people. And I would imagine you use the audience to help you see which aspects of the other people are most easily transmitted. But since we're talking about changing minds, can you remember at which point you stopped being a student and began to transmogrify into a performer whose potential seems to me to be unlimited?
Well, thank you. My agent, ladies and gentlemen. I think that I was writing the voices of these people. That was really the sort of the turning point. I began to not only observe them, but to sort of try to slip into, some window onto their consciousness and just sort of sit there and think as they might think and try to write as they might write. And I started writing poems, some very bad poems, but I started writing whatever I thought might really reflect accurately their experience, which required me to read a lot more and talk to, friends about their experiences if I hadn't grown up with exactly that experience. But I began to write as these people, and that sort of freed my voice as a writer. And I think...
Was there a moment where you sort of came out to your family and said, I'm not going to be a lawyer, a doctor, even a writer, I'm going on stage?
Yes, and it also sounded something like, Mom, I'm leaving Bryn Mawr, and I'm going home to, experiment at poetry cafes on open mic night. Hope that's all right with you. I plan to pay my bills
that way.
Can
you imitate what she said?
Wait a minute. Are you coming home now? Or okay. Well, let's talk about this. I don't want to hem you in. Let's think about this. Let's talk about this. Now, my mother, I should say, is a clinician. She's an OBGYN, and so the very idea that I not only didn't go into medicine, I didn't become a professional. I was sort of going to be birthing imaginary people for not a very good living. I'm sure that scared her terribly.
But no malpractice issues.
No malpractice issues, no insurance, no HMOs. I think I came out ahead.
Howard, obviously, Sarah does, in addition to her many talents, as you suggested, she represents what you call these various intelligences. Do people, especially, say, people in a place like the Aspen Ideas Festival where they all have 800 SATs and high IQs, ever accuse you of misusing the word intelligence to apply to these other things to sort of make people without 800 SATs feel better?
Absolutely. And I always say, fine to call it a talent if you call being good with words or good with music a talent. What I object to is taking two of them, language and logic, putting them on a pedestal and neglecting everything else. But let me tell you a story about that. I once wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which I said that I thought the SAT should be untimed. And that's because there are very few things in life where timing is that important. As long as you can get the answers right, it's fine. I've never had an experience like this. I sat at my computer and I heard one ding after another of people writing back, but it was about half and half. Half the people agreed with me, the other half that didn't. Do you know who disagreed the most? People for whom having their high SAT was the most important thing they ever achieved in their life. But, of course, Aspen is not composed of people like that. It's composed of people with multiple talents, and they could all go and do exactly what Rashid and Miss Lady did without any rehearsal whatsoever.
Dr. Howard Gardner, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Howard Gardner is a professor of psychology at Harvard. If any of you out there have a good story about a time that you really changed your mind, tell us about it. Leave a comment at studio360.org. Coming up, more characters from the endlessly talented Sarah Jones and live music from folk rock renegade legend Steve Earle. That is just ahead in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
There's a hole in my shoe. I don't mind, 'cause it keeps me connected to the ground. And I'm feeling like maybe if I ain't careful, I just blow away. Then lightning strikes, a thunder rolls, and I'm okay.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. Today we're taking you to the Rocky Mountains, where we taped the show live at the Aspen Ideas Festival in 2008. One of my very favorite musicians, Steve Earle, is my guest. Steve, it is great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So, here you are. How does a lefty rebel singing about Emma Goldman feel about being among all these members of the establishment? I mean, the man is essentially out here.
Yeah, that, I haven't seen, you know, that many corporate logos outside of sports stadiums in my life. I was walking down the sidewalk. It is pretty intimidating. I don't think that all of our problems are due to the fact that corporations are inherently evil, although some corporations are inherently evil. But the reality of the situation is that artists have always had to look for funding somewhere. And I've taken money from really huge corporations for most of my career. I was on major labels for a long time. And of course that business completely and totally collapse. There basically are no major corporations to take money from to make music anymore. So
that solves that problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, you told me before the show that you used your time in Colorado here in Aspen to go fishing.
Oh yeah, this leg of the tour was booked. We fished Taos, and which is kind of where I learned to fish, and we fished Telluride, out of Telluride, the last couple of days. I was fishing at about 8,000 feet all day yesterday. So if I fall asleep, that's what it is. It's not because I think you're boring. I'm just whipped. You know, it's one of those.
Now, you come from the southern part of the United States.
I do.
But your latest record, which is called Washington Square Serenade, is a love song to New York City.
Well, Alison Moore in New York City. It's a less political, I guess, on the surface than my last couple of records, because it was time to take care of some personal business. But it's big changes in my life. I moved to New York 3 years ago, basically because I lived in Tennessee for 32 years. I'm from Texas originally, and I hitchhiked to Tennessee when I was 19 to do this. I didn't know you could get to Tennessee any other way but hitchhike till I was 26 or 27. And I thought about going to New York then, and I started making records, and then I started going to New York to play, and I've always loved it. And basically, more than anything else, I became, coming to grips with mortality in sort of a positive way. The idea that I've obviously missed the live fast and leave a good looking corpse thing. So, you know, as I get older, Tennessee is a beautiful place, but for me personally, I was able to live there for 30 years mainly because I wasn't there very much. I travel all around the world. And, you know, do I want to, is that where if I become infirm for some reason and get my wings clipped, do I want to be in Tennessee? And when I asked myself that question, the answer was no. I'd rather be one of those old commies in a wheelchair that run over my foot on Bleecker Street. It looks like a better deal to me.
So it's worked out. There's no culture shock. You're no longer a fish out of water in New York?
No, we're actually going to get a place in Woodstock, it looks like, a little closer. Just that's for Allison, though. I could stay in the city all the time. After being a total motorhead all my life, I spent my whole youth building motorcycles and cars that I couldn't keep on the ground. And now I really don't care whether I ever get in a car again. Just the whole idea of having a 24-hour day public transportation system, be able to, for $2, start a journey to anywhere in the world from a block from my house, depending on which direction I walk, is... seems like, you know, pretty cool to me right now.
I'm fascinated with it. Instead of
continuing to talk about the charms of New York, you have a song about the move called Tennessee Blues.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to hear it.
Can I do that from right here? Y'all prepared for that? Will that be too big of a curveball? You got me? Or... My mirror, pedal on the floor, climb in New York City, won't be back no more, won't be back no more, boss won't see me around, goodbye guitar town. Goes out on the highway, voices in the wind, telling me we may never pass this way again. Voices on the highway, angels beckoning like a long lost friend. Fare thee well, I'm bound to roam. This ain't never been my home. Stranger in my mirror, lines around my eyes, string around my finger, but I don't remember why. Don't remember why, boys, don't remember how. Goodbye, guitar town. This ain't never been my home. Blue dog on my floorboard, redhead by my side, cross the mighty Hudson River to New York City side. Redhead by my side, boy, sweetest thing I found. Goodbye, guitar.
Steve Earle. Now, I left the middle of the country and moved to New York a long time ago when I was very young. And I moved there because of an essay I'd happened to read in college by E.B. White. E.B. White wrote about there being three New York cities, the New York of commuters, the New York of people born and raised there, and, as E.B. White wrote, what he called the greatest New York, which he said consists of people who were born somewhere else and came to New York in quest of something, people who embrace New York with the intense excitement of first love and must come to the city willing to be lucky. Well, that was the way it was for me 32 years ago. I was in New York just out of college. New York itself was just out of bankruptcy. The subway cars were covered in graffiti. None of them were air-conditioned. Crime and pornography were rampant. I loved it. One Friday, my boss at the time gave me two tickets to the New York Philharmonic, and I still remember the date. It was November 4th, 1977. I asked a friend to go. She couldn't. But then she called back a half hour later, said she knew a girl who just graduated from college. She was pretty. She was smart. She was spunky. She was Midwestern, like me, new to the city. Now, I had never been on a blind date, but I phoned her, and she said yes. I picked her up in a taxi. It was a Checker cab. We went to the concert. By the way, there are no more Checker cabs in New York City. The concert we saw was the Third Symphony of Sir Michael Tippett. It was highly modern and dissonant, and I worried that this girl would think I was some kind of snobby intellectual. And it turned out I was right. So to make up for that, I proceeded to make it the datiest date of my life. For dinner, we went to this cool new restaurant on Columbus Avenue in Manhattan. And that restaurant, in fact, turned out to be the place that kind of marked the rebirth of the Upper West Side when it was discovered by people as young as we were then. By the way, it no longer exists. After dinner, we wandered a mile down to Times Square to a gaming arcade, and we played pinball for another hour or two. That place, and every other pinball arcade, no longer exists. It was after midnight. It was 1977. So we went to a disco. I confess it. It was called New York, New York, and we danced. That place and all the other discos in Manhattan are long gone. In the 3 decades since then, New York City has changed so incredibly much. The subways are air-conditioned, for starters. There are 75% fewer murders. Times Square is spiffy and safe, safe-ish. Neighborhoods have been reborn all over the city. For 4 elections in a row, New York City has elected a Republican mayor. Now, I no longer go on blind dates. That one was my first and my last, because while all the places I went that night are all gone, the girl is still around. I married her. We're still together. We still live in New York. And really, really all because one night in 1977 in New York City, we were both willing to be lucky.
Okay, I'm sorry. Hi, how are you? My name is Nareda. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit nervous and everything. Okay. My God. Okay, that was a really beautiful story, and I wanted to say that I'm very happy to be here on this occasion with all of you. How are you? First of all, okay, I'm very excited, and I'm trying not to be nervous, as I said, because every time I get nervous, I start to talk really fast. Nobody can understand nothing I'm saying, which is very frustrating for me. As you can imagine, usually I just have to take a deep breath, so... With the altitude, it's extremely difficult. So, but I love Aspen. I'm very happy to be here. Sarah Jones just asked me to come here and share a New York story like you have. And first of all, I wanted to say that, you know, I am Dominican, and I don't think there's any other Dominicans here. But there are a lot of Mexican people here in the state of Colorado, and that's close enough for me right now. I'm also actually really from New York. You could say that I grew up in the capital of Dominican Republic, public, otherwise known as Washington Heights. I actually was born in Dominican Republic, and that's where my New York story starts. So I'm not very good at doing this. I know Sarah Jones, Kurt, you all just come out here and you're like, blah, blah, blah. You could talk and the people love you and stuff, but this is like a little bit new for me. So if you could just like bear with me. Okay, sorry about that. So my story basically is that my parents, they brought me here to this country when I was little. And, you know, well, I think it's important to say that they didn't want to leave home. Nobody does. And I think people forget that it's not easy to just pull up your roots and go someplace new. But, you know, they didn't have the opportunity to have the life that they wanted there. And so, you know, especially with our government the way it was back at that time, I just remember my mother saying all the time that she just wanted to leave the bad people behind and go someplace where she could be with the good people, la buena gente. So I remember I was little, but on the plane to JFK, my father had our life savings, everything we had as a family, in a bank check in his wallet. Because as he said, that's how the Americans do it. Only some unsophisticated immigrant from the countryside, a plátano, as he would say, would be caught dead carrying that much cash. But somehow, between arriving at customs and the taxi, maybe it was the exhaustion or the excitement of finally arriving, making it to Nueva York, my father lost his wallet. I had never seen my papi cry in his life, in my life. But there he was, begging God for a miracle. And a few days and 1,000 prayers later, we got a call that my father's wallet had been found with the check still inside. And as my parents were singing the praises of our new home country, an American so good and pure that people returned money to strangers, we found out it was a Dominican lady who grew up 2 towns over from Papi. She had found the wallet, kept it safe, and we had our first New York miracle sitting in the living room of Doña Marisol, eating bizcocho and drinking café from home. So that's my story. I survived it, and I survived telling it here. So now I just want to turn it over to the real expert, Kurt Anderson. Thank you.
Thank you. And now I can say, actually, thank you, Sarah Jones. Steve, I know you have a song somewhere in this vicinity, City of Immigrants.
Yeah.
And that person you dedicated this this new record to is going to join you, your wife, Allison Moore.
Yeah.
See, I'm seriously overmarried, as you can see.
Aren't we all?
Okay, here we go. Came about because the guy that owns the deli at the end of my street made me feel really stupid when I realized one day that he speaks three languages that I know of, including English, better than I do.
Living in a city of immigrants, I don't need to go traveling. Open the door and the world walks in. Living in a city of immigrants. Living in a city that never sleeps. Heart keeping time to 1,000 beats. Singing languages I don't speak. Living in a city of immigrants. City black. City white. City light. City of incense. City of sweat. City of tears. City of prayers. City of immigrants. Living in a city where the dreams of men reach up and touch the sky and then tumble back down to up again. Living in a city that never quits. Living in a city where streets are paved with good intentions and a people's faith and a sacred promise, a statue made. Living in a city of immigrants. City of stone. City of steel. City of wheels. Constantly spinning. City of sweat. City of tea. City of prayers. City of immigrants.
Putting some of us in the mood to return to New York City. And bringing us nearly to the end of today's show, I want to thank Stephen Allison. I want to thank Howard Gardner as well. And I want to thank my friend Sarah Jones. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Kurt, wait a minute. I'm sorry, I have to interrupt because, hold on, I can't see a thing, as you can imagine. Hold on, I'm coming here with the glasses. They don't know in radio land. Okay, now, Kurt Anderson, he would never tell you this himself, he's too modest, but this man, we want to thank you. I'd like the audience to join me in thanking Kurt and Studio 360. There we are. Now I can see you. Isn't he adorable? I love this man. And listen, as I told you, he's very modest. He wouldn't say this, but he's won a Peabody Award. He's fabulous. I love this man. I love being here with him. And I hope that all of you will take these ideas and enjoy them in Aspen or wherever they find you. Isn't that right?
Thank you, Lorraine. I love you.
Oh, good, good. I love you too, sweetheart. But not in a way that should upset Ian. Hi, sweetheart.
This live edition of Studio 360 was a co-production of the Aspen Institute and The Atlantic Magazine. Special thanks to Jamie Miller, Jim Spiegelman, Kitty Boone, Walter Isaacson, Jen Myers and the Aspen Institute, Colorado AV, Bill Hayden, Bill Alvarez, Jeff Scher, and Shay Lynch. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramosferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Rick Kwan,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks also to Chris Bannon, Julie Burstein, Ed Haber, Rob Christensen, Nuala McGovern, Lisa Allison, Ave Carrillo, Indira Etwaru, and Jill DeBoff. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
3, 4.
We asked for your songs and you sent them.
You've got a deadline and I've got two headlines.
We promised you mixtapes and we made them.
We're having fun in high school.
Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen join me to reveal the winner of our Battle of the High School Bands next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
The high school.